Hey guys, it's Emma
and Shannon,
and welcome back to our podcast, She's an Engineer.
In this episode, we're going to talk about the history of women in bicycling, and we also have a special guest, Matthew Steele, and so I'm just going to have him give us a brief overview of his background.
Hey everybody, this is Matt Steele. I'm super excited to be here, and like Shannon said, I'll be talking about the history of women in bicycling. So I guess a little bit about myself. I'm a graduate of Montana State University. I got my bachelor's in civil engineering, and I have a focus in transportation engineering, which does everything with roads, streets, bike lanes. If you're ever mad at traffic, that's usually my wheelhouse. So yeah, that's me.
Well, thanks for your background, and I think we're just going to dive into this topic, so I'm going to hand it over to you to talk about the history of women in bicycling.
Killer. So a good way to start is probably with a quote from Susan B. Anthony. So I quoted directly from her in a 1896 interview. "Let me tell you what I think of bicycling. I think it has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. I stand and rejoice every time I see a woman ride by on a wheel. It gives a woman a feeling of freedom and self-reliance. It makes her feel as if she were independent. The moment she takes her seat, she knows she can't get into harm unless she gets off her bicycle. And away she goes, the picture of free, untrammeled womanhood." It's a pretty powerful stuff. And, you know, to really contextualize this topic, maybe just a brief history of the bicycle in of itself, so the thing that everybody sees riding around on. You know, the bicycle originally started right around the late 1700s, early 1800s. It's a mystery really where and how it started, but we know Victorian era Paris, right about that time. But what we imagine to be more of a early bicycle is called the velociped. It was originally unsteerable, it was wooden, it was called the bone shaker, it had no shocks. It was very uncomfortable to ride. Then, right around the 1870s, 1880s, we get what was called the ordinary. If you ever have the picture in your head of the bicycle with that really big front wheel, that's called the ordinary. They were super common around kind of sporting young white men in Paris and then eventually in London. They were kind of the dandy horse, as it was called. But they were also very unsafe. Going over your handlebars during an accident was super common. So right around the 1890s, we got what was called the safety bicycle. And you can kind of note that it was distinct for two reasons. One, it was, by its name, safety bicycle, a lot more safe. Both of the wheels were the same size. You could steer it. But more importantly, it was very affordable. So suddenly we started seeing more classes, more people starting to use the bicycle to get around, and it totally transformed our modern transportation landscape. This is also kind of the transition between Victorian era to the Industrial Revolution. So that's just a little history on the bicycle itself. And right about this time, we started seeing more kinds of people riding it. Originally, it was just, again, sporting young white men. And then we started seeing more people using it to get around. Most importantly, for the point of this podcast, was the history of women in it. So women started riding bicycles, and immediately it caused just a huge social uproar for a variety of reasons. But again, people who wanted to challenge the norms to get around for their own volition and to exert their own sense of independence really got to challenge so many facets of Victorian era society and even going on to modern 1920s America. So the first thing they really challenged was science. So the whole concept of women riding bicycles, which is again usually the purview of kind of sporting white guys, was that they were also physically strong. You know, you saw women using a lot of effort to use these bicycles, and it really challenge that prevailing theory of women, largely at this time, upper-class white women, as being physically frail. So suddenly, when society started seeing all of these folks, these women riding bicycles, clearly they're not frail, clearly they're just as strong as, you know, the white guys who are riding them. So it, you know, it really started to establish more equality between the sexes. But funny enough, as soon as this started to happen in society, the scientific nonsense of women being frail was replaced by a new sort of scientific consensus, which was bicycle mania. So scientists and medical doctors at the time were under the impression that, you know, riding a bicycle, because people were so into it, and again, because there were so many accidents, it was a new thing, that the only reason people would be compelled to ride bicycles as compared to horses or what would then be, you know, popular early automobiles was clearly some sort of insanity specific to bicycles, and it was given a name, bicycle mania. So as women suffragists were getting on the bicycles and they were starting to exert their independence, they started having attached to them from the modern medical community, bicycle mania. It was a very interesting shift from medical diagnoses between people. So after that, from challenging science, then we kind of get this transition to challenging clothing. So as women were riding bicycles, you could see a big shift in their attire as well. You know, you can imagine riding a bicycle, you know, obviously your legs are straddling the frame on there. And this isn't very conducive to skirts or corsets, which were the, you know, typical attire of Victorian era Western world. So at about this time, there's a big transition to bloomers or pantaloons, as it were. And the social outcry attached to this was just absolutely crazy, because again, it was seen as a like a moral panic. Being able to see the distinct figure of women's legs was very outrageous at the time. But again, as you know, this became more and more common for women to be riding bicycles, it necessitated getting rid of skirts, getting rid of corsets, what have you. To quote Elizabeth Cody Stanton, who was another famous suffragist from the late 1800s, women are riding to suffrage on a bicycle. And it was really cool to get to see, historically speaking, you know, empowerment through clothing as it attaches itself to bicycling. You know, just getting rid of this restrictive clothing that wouldn't let, you know, women travel comfortably. You know, you can also see this as the bicycle challenging horse-drawn transportation as well. Traditionally speaking, in Victorian era Western world, women were also not able to ride a horse normally. They'd have to sit side saddle on them. And at that, it's difficult to steer a horse when you're riding side saddle. So traditionalists started leaning more towards horses, saying, you know, it's more appropriate for women to ride side saddle on horses. And anybody who wanted to challenge the current paradigm of women's independence also favored the bicycle as a means of saying, we're not going to go with the restrictive clothing anymore. And this really was the birth of what you can call rational dress, which was basically, you know, dress not necessarily for your cultural customs, but for your daily activities. And, you know, for any gearheads out there, if anybody prefers to shop at a place like REI or any outdoor clothing store, this is probably the birth of that whole fashion subset.
Well, I think it's pretty interesting that when you talk about women's suffrage movements, you don't normally include the history of the bicycle. So I think it's just important to touch on in this episode because it has triggered a lot of things in the women's suffrage movement, like you said, especially with clothing and giving women the independence to move around on their own.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, it's important maybe at this point as well to note that the bicycle didn't usher in a new era of women's rights. You know, it was really brave women who used bicycling as a tool. And, you know, it's fun. It's really cool to get to see this juxtaposition of technology and, you know, a human independent movement. But again, putting everything in the context is bicycles were there. It's really cool to get to see these movements happen through them. But we got to give a lot of credit to, you know, the brave people who were there. We just like to think that maybe bicycles as both pedestrian accelerators, you can move 3 to 6 times faster on a bicycle, maybe in the same sense that independent movements can move a little bit quicker and a little bit smoother with new technological advances.
Yeah, like you said about the brave women kind of initiating this movement, but I'm just imagining Victorian era women wearing like really long dresses, the first ones that started riding bicycles. That's such a challenge. Like, go them.
Yeah. Yeah, for real. And, you know, it's cool to get to see, you know, fashion icons of the time, too. Like the big Knickerbocker suit was kind of inspired by the bicycle wanting to come around with somebody like Kitty Knox was a good example of that. But yeah, I suppose all of this is also contextualized against the Industrial Revolution, when women started coming into the workforce. Again, skirts, corsets, all those things don't fit into what we imagine accurately to be the factory conditions in which women were working. Again, these are just the historical intersections of technology, independent movements, and just historical context. You know, at the same time that we were seeing women going into the workforce, they needed independent means of getting there. And, you know, again, this started what was called the woman question back in the day, which was, you know, if we're upheaving these social norms, you know, what's going to happen to society if this is the one that gets me is if we have unchaperoned, you can't see me because it's a podcast, but I'm putting up some air quotes here, unchaperoned women moving around on their bicycles to and from work. And just, you know, trying to really put our minds back into that state is crazy. But again, bicycles helped close that distance between where people were working, specifically working class women, to the factories that they were then purveying at. It was really cool to get to see just these norms come about. Mm-hmm. In the same context, there's a person that I'd like to highlight in this because it, you know, there's so many great figures in the history of women bicycling, but just one really stands out, and it's somebody called Kitty Knox. So to kind of set this up for you, Kitty Knox came about when the women's suffrage movement was known for leaving behind women of color. At the time, for especially in America, women to hope to get the right to vote, the 19th Amendment couldn't be sold both on women's voting rights and giving women of color the right to vote. So it wasn't uncommon for the women's suffragist movement to intentionally leave behind women of color. So enter at this time, Kitty Knox. In 1894, she comes in riding her bicycle at the League of American Wheelmen. Now, it's important to note that the League of American Wheelmen had always tried to, at this point in time, exclude people of color and exclude women, both of whom were starting to gain independence through the use and the popularity of bicycles. So prior to Kitty Knox doing her famous 1894 ride, the League of American Wheelmen had enacted a whites-only proposition.
Sorry, I have a question. Can you explain what the League of American Wheelmen is?
Sure. So looking back in history at when bicycles became very popular amidst people, especially in America, it was important for bicyclists to organize as groups. At this time, horse advocates, automobile advocates, and even just general public fervor were very much against bicycles, but people who were either very sporting or very interested in bicycling wanted the right to do it unassaulted. So right about that same time, the late 1800s, we had upwards of 10,000 plus people in America all organizing what was called the Bicycle Voting Bloc. And it was just, you know, organizations of people who rode bicycles and who were, you know, standing up for politicians who were also pro-bicycle. One of the leading organizations of this was the League of American Wheelmen. And again, you can even see from the title of the organization, Wheelmen, it was already a little bit exclusionary. But this was the precursor to the League of American Bicyclists, the American Bicycle League. There's a few others out there, but this was like the precursor, the very first one. And again, pretty exclusionary, I should say, very exclusionary standards to it. Kitty Knox, before getting her membership, had snuck in. She was of a biracial background, so she already knew that something was going to be happening at about that time. So she sneaks in her membership And then in the 1894 ride, she goes out riding with them. And already this causes a stir. But Kitty Knox is also a very proficient bicycle rider. So she's one of the early examples of people who are doing public bicycle tricks. That is to say, riding without your hands, doing wheelies. And you can imagine in like 1894 America, she's riding around with the League of American Wheelmen, showing them up, being a way better bicyclist, dressed in a very awesome bicycling outfit. You know, you can imagine people with their bicycle jerseys and their bicycle shorts now, but back in the day, what really earned her her celebrity was her series of custom-designed bicycle costumes for women. Mm-hmm. Bloomers were a huge piece of women's fashion back in the day for earning celebrity. So she's, again, out there popping wheelies, rocking some awesome bicycle fashion, and causing a huge stir. It's just the coolest scene to imagine in late 1800s America.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that brief history of women in biking, and I want to ask, are there any important items to note on women bicycling today?
Yeah, so, you know, the whole point of recognizing our history is to also see where it intersects in our present, and it's so important to understand how much further we have to go with bicycling and people's independent movements. So, taking just a short step back, oppressive governments have pretty traditionally, you know, had similar hallmarks of their regimes taking over. And funny enough, one of the common threads between oppressive governments is the banning of bicycles for certain people. That was one of the first things that Nazi Germany would do whenever they would invade a specific country. They would ban either everybody from riding bikes or more specifically targeted groups. The persecution of Jews in the Netherlands during World War II was a big one. They were refused the ability to ride bikes. And then that was extended to everybody when the Dutch underground, the resistance movement, were using bikes to form a sort of guerrilla warfare against them. So, you know, keeping that in mind, now looking ahead to like 2016, for example, the Iranian supreme leader imposed a fatwa on women publicly riding bikes because, and, you know, you'll pardon me being a little frank here, but the justification for this fatwa was that women publicly riding bikes would stir on men sexually. They were to see them in such a compromising and energetic position. So now, you know, this continues today where Iranian clerics will commonly ban women from riding their bikes. And thankfully now a resistance movement has popped up wherein women will ride their bikes while wearing t-shirts that say, "Please do not look at me in a sexual way. I'm just trying to ride my bike." Mm. So I mean, that's still going on today in Iran and some other more oppressive Middle Eastern and Asian countries on women's rights. It's if you want to look on Instagram, there's a good slew of Iranian women activists who are out there riding their bike and kicking butt. And even more recently here on in America, in 2020, women organized a ride in L.A. and then a similar ride in New York to protest the murder of George Floyd. The ability for bicycle ride-ins to give image to underrepresented groups or underrepresented topics is increasingly common. Ride-ins, lions is another one where groups of bicyclists will ride up to City Hall and they'll all lay down on their bike to basically illustrate one dead cyclist for each individual in the protest for bicyclists who were killed everywhere. And I'd be loath not to, you know, mention a few like current organizations that are really leading the charge on giving bicycle inclusion and bicycle activism. One of the ones that I think is the coolest is Black Girls Do Bike. It's an organization started by Monica Garrison in 2013. And my understanding is that the goal of the organization is to connect women and girls of color to support joyful cycling community activism. There's 100 plus chapters nationwide, and it's a very cool organization, one of many that does that.
Awesome. And so, of course, this podcast is primarily based about engineering. So how does engineering design and women in bicycling intersect?
That's a great question. And, you know, for civil engineers or really urban planners in general, they aim to accomplish what's called soft infrastructure. And you can see the soft infrastructure being implemented, capturing one of the five, it's called the five C's. So they're basically like targets of projects being implemented to hit one of these points. So the first one is comfort, and that's just to, you know, provide bike lanes with trees to, you know, shade from the sun and make sure bike parking is well lit and visible. And again, this allows people who maybe don't feel safe or who feel marginalized in their safety, in their communities, to be able to access bicycling or bicycle facilities. It's extremely important. The other one is convenience. Women on average make 100 more trips per year than men in a caregiver capacity or even for running errands. So, you know, to really facilitate this using of a bicycle for common day-to-day activities, it's important to provide connectivity to community assets and neighborhoods. I believe one of your previous episodes actually talked about food deserts. And that's a big issue where, you know, if you're wanting to be able to go to the grocery store, you know, do you have easy access to it, whether by public transportation or more importantly, which is the current litmus test of good urban planning, is can you bike to it? And that's one of the big things we've been trying to hit here. Another C to consider in here are consumer products. And, you know, for a long time, bicycle equipment, bicycle components have all been angled specifically at white men. So, you know, you can see the development of new saddles being a comfort in consumer products, helmets that are more considerate of Afro-textured hair, braids, locks. This even goes so far into public outreach events where when people want to stage ride-ins or to engage their community through bicycle activities, that they do keep these things in mind. You know, what kind of clothing and what kind of common products do reach a wider demographic of people. Mm-hmm. You know, another portion of this is also most bicycle shops, I think it's like 90% of them in America, are owned by white men, but that other 10% are important to highlight. So just another little item out there, go support your women-owned bike businesses because they represent the future in bike consumer products. Another C to consider is confidence. Targeted education around confidence building on your bicycles is necessary to ensure people ride their bikes. A common tool for urban planners to try and implement multimodal transportation networks is to pair it with an education campaign aimed at marginalized groups who maybe don't ride their bikes everywhere or don't feel comfortable riding their bikes in traffic. You know, get out there and teach people to feel awesome and strong and confident on their bicycles. The last C to consider is community. And, you know, the big part of this is engage with like a diverse group of people for public input on projects. As transportation engineers, whenever we try to, you know, implement any sort of new transportation facility, project, or series of projects, it's important to know who we're aiming this at, and to really engage this facet of design is to ask people who, you know, you want to see use it and see what their barriers are to it and make sure they feel a part of it, because, you know, we're all one big community of folks and it's important to have everybody's input in it. On top of that, when we output community engagement materials, be it like ad campaigns, flyers, or even just posters, making sure that you have a representation of people who are more diverse. Instead of having the same people on all of your pamphlets, make sure you got more folks who are representative of your community. Mm-hmm. And those are the five C's, and that's really, you know, what we aim for in transportation and urban planning, is making sure folks can feel safe, comfortable, and, well, maybe a little happy out there on bicycles too.
In your opinion, I know you talked more about urban planning and that's more of what you do. What do you think communities in the suburbs can do to enhance, I guess, bicycling in general?
That's a really good question. And, you know, unfortunately, in suburbs, folks feel very cut off from safe bicycle infrastructure. Most of those roads in suburbs are not well designed for bikes. They tend to be very far away from services that they'd want to bike to. And the big one out there is really support traffic calming initiatives or look to see where they're being implemented. Those sorts of initiatives are now in America becoming very popular. I guess to give a little background on pop-up traffic calming. So after the Second World War, we had a lot of infrastructure put in that was very auto-centric, very, very car-heavy. And unfortunately, that infrastructure is not conducive to healthy communities or to, you know, very accessible communities like suburbs, like you said, Emma. And to remedy this now, what we started doing is playing around with lane striping, striping bicycle lanes into suburbs, starting to mess with zoning. So for a long time, suburbs were surrounded by other suburbs. But now, before we start putting in more suburbs, local municipal bodies are saying, you know what, let's put a grocery store between these suburbs, because if we have all the suburbs on one side and all the grocery stores on the other, it's going to make it kind of hard for some people in some suburbs to be able to easily get to them. Yeah, that's a big one. I guess also if you're living in a suburb, keep an eye out for any sort of people out there working to put up a traffic calming project and really understand what they're doing. It's really low cost, but it's very effective.
Yeah, and I want to add one more thing, which I think goes along with your competency, which is if you do live in a suburb and want to bike more, it's also important to learn about your local biking laws. Here in Idaho, if you're on a bike and you're at a red light, you have to stop at the red light, but then if it's clear, you can proceed through the intersection. So maybe learn a little bit more about bike laws, also how to signal if you're turning right or left, and get a good helmet. Oh, and then lastly, if you do have a busing system in your suburb, learn how to put your bike on the front of the bus, because if you have a longer commute, you can bike part of the way and then hop on the public transportation and take your bike with you.
To jump in on that, thanks, Shannon. That actually reminds me, on my desk here, I have a little pamphlet. It's a educational material guide that we were passing out in Montana. It's called Montana Bicycle Laws, Pocket Reference Guide. And a lot of what you were saying is in here. I just want to add in there, make sure you have a light on your bike. If you're ever riding at night, you want to stay nice and visible. Bicyclists can use turn lanes and should. Bicyclists can legally use the full lane. And never ride against traffic. Those are all, I think, maybe common misconceptions. But, you know, when you're a bicyclist out there, you are a vehicle and you do have a right to your space. Your tax dollars pay for it. And even as a vulnerable user, you have the right to feel safe and you have the right to get around however you would like to get around.
Great. Well, I hope all of our listeners learned something about biking and the history of women in biking. And overall, I hope this is encouraging to everyone to bike more, maybe add biking into their commute. So, Emma, do you have anything else to add?
No, just that it's definitely encouraging me. I've been thinking more about getting into biking, especially since I kind of want to try to train for a triathlon. So I think this would definitely help. But I should read up more about New Jersey biking laws for sure. I think I know most of the things, but I should brush up on my knowledge. Yeah, I think that's it. So we hope you enjoyed this episode, and thanks, Matt, for coming on and being our expert on women in biking. And we will see you guys again in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.